Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Good evening, everybody, everyone. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour. The Lifeboat Hour, where everybody knows that this is one place where listeners can tap into some sanity for 1 hour a week to learn about how to build lifeboats for navigating the present and coming chaos. We've just had one of the most horrifying weeks in world events that we've seen for a while. We've had and continue to have the bombardment and ground invasion of Gaza by Israel. We've had a tragic downing of a Malaysian passenger plane over the Ukraine. And we continue to have tens of thousands of refugee children showing up at the southern border of the United States, a direct result of the failed and brutal U.S. policies in Central America over the past 35 years. Also this week, we received the latest climate report from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which essentially says that greenhouse gases continue to climb, that the Earth's temperature continues to rise, sea surface temperatures are increasing, oceans are rising, and Arctic ice is going away. Now, of course, as usual, our mainstream media sources are not telling us the whole truth about these and most other national and international events. However, there are courageous voices in alternative media, and I don't need to tell you that Progressive Radio Network is one of the bright lights on a sea of lies and omissions by corporate media. In addition, one of the very bright lights in alternative media is a woman named Abby Martin from Russia TV America, and she's going to be with us next week. Abby has interviewed me twice. The second interview aired this past Friday night, which I know some of you have seen, and I'm really looking forward to having her with us next week. Before I introduce our guest, I want to let everyone know that when you call into the show, you may or may not get through due to the fact that we have just one engineer to answer all the calls. And last week, a huge number of people called in, and we just couldn't take all the calls, for which we apologize. Please know that we will do our best to take your call, but we can't promise that we'll be able to. Later in tonight's show, we will be taking callers and taking as many callers as possible. So, if we allow ourselves to be present with the pain and suffering on our planet, even for a moment, it feels as if we are inhabiting a planet in hospice. We talked about this extensively last week when Guy McPherson was with us, but tonight we're going to explore this notion in depth from a different angle with a man who has written an extraordinary article entitled Planetary Hospice, Rebirthing Planet Earth. You may have seen the paper on Nature Bats Last earlier this year, or you may have seen it on my site, or on the Ecological Buddhism website. I'm talking about Ziwa Woodberry. Now, his last name is spelled Z-H-I-W-A, but it's pronounced Ziwa, and he is a long-time eco-activist who holds a doctorate in natural law. He recently obtained an advanced degree in eco-psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies and is helping to launch an eco-resilience program there. He's the senior editor of NAGPA International, dedicated to helping people on the path of awakening, and is also a contributing editor for the online journal Immanence. Ziwa provides hospice care and spiritual counsel for people and their loved ones facing the end of life. He's a dedicated Tibetan Buddhist and lives in Berkeley, California. He will be talking to us about the Planetary Hospice article and also his personal vision, a planetary hospice movement. Zhiwa Woodbury, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Well, thanks, Carolyn. It's great to be with you.
You know, Zhiwa, you've made quite a journey from environmental law to activism to eco-psychology to being a hospice caregiver. And you've shared with me that at the core of this journey was your discovery that the root problem with our imbalance with the environment is a spiritual dis-ease. Please tell us more about this.
Sure. Most of my career in law was dedicated to changing the way we manage our national forests as an advocate for wildlife. And, you know, all the way up until the 70s, the Forest Service had a practice of removing all dead and dying trees from the forest because they wanted to salvage their commercial value, and they didn't think they had any value there in the woods. Then they discovered that dead trees are actually the source of life for nearly all the birds and critters in the forest, and that the absence of dead trees was killing our forests, making them lifeless. So when I first got involved with ecosystem protection, we were always fighting these so-called salvage timber sales, and which saw death and disease as a problem to be cured with logging. And one day I was on a spiritual retreat for eco-activists in Paradise, Idaho, and we were doing solo vision quests into the surrounding old-growth forest. I sat for a long time on a log in the middle of the forest, breathing it all in, just trying to be, you know, part of all of that, without really thinking about it. And I gained this deep appreciation while I was sitting there for just how much death is integrated into and is a part of life in nature, you know, how vital it is. And to the point where you really, you know, sitting there, I couldn't really separate where life and death, you know, began and end. It was so intertwined, and the dead trees just teem with life. And so in that moment, I realized that all of our misguided management of wildlife and forests and the environment was rooted in our fear of death and dying, that we were, you know, projecting these repressed fears on nature, pretending we could somehow remove the dying process from nature itself in the same way we tried to remove it from our own lives, you know, warehousing the elderly and infirm and then putting sick and dying people in sterile hospitals at the end of their life, pretending somehow death is not a part of life the way it always has been. And I guess I just started to see the big picture at that point. And, you know, but it didn't take long before all we were arguing about was fire. The Forest Service is all about fire management now, and it's no longer about wildlife management or even logging, you know, really. It's climate change just took over and changed everything, and got to a point where I just felt like we were arguing over the trees while the forest was burning, and I moved on, you know, to study why humans are so out of balance with our environment.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that. And so this year you published the Planetary Hospice article, and I'd like you to explain how that came about in terms of radical eco-psychology, Zen hospice, and the psychology of death and dying. And the next and very related question would be, why planetary hospice?
Well, I've been doing hospice caregiving and studying psychology in Montana for a while I was also advocating for wildlife. And I came to San Francisco to study eco-psychology and Buddhist psychology at CIIS, and also to offer service at Zen Hospice. Because both of these institutions have, like, amazing reputations. So my first semester, I took eco-psychology with Craig Chalquist, who's the chair of our department. And Andy Fisher's book, Radical Eco-Psychology, Psychology in the Service of Life, seemed to have the answers to all of the deepest questions I've been carrying around for most of my adult life. It's just this brilliant, it was his doctoral thesis, actually, and it's been in print now for about 10 years. And, you know, for those who, you know, don't know what eco-psychology is, it's, you know, the difference between eco-psychology and psychology is that eco-psychology places our psyche in the natural world and sees the natural world as part of our psyche, much like that life and death in the forest story I was telling you about. You know, it's
right.
It's like that. There's no boundary there. And where psychology traditionally has always seen us as sociocultural creatures, you know, kind of apart from our nature, apart from nature and our environment. So this eco-psychological view of the world was actually presaged by the father of quantum physics, Werner Heisenberg, who I have this wonderful quote that I love from him, where he said, the world, this is like his conclusion from all of his studies in physics, and he said, the world thus appears as a complicated tissue of events in which connections of different kinds alternate or overlap or combine and therefore determine the texture of the whole. And that's really, that's like right in line with Andy Fisher's idea of one flesh, he calls it, which he defines as all phenomena interweave as a single cloth or tissue that are mutually informative in their commingling with one another because they are of the same elemental stuff. So this is why, you know, just as an aside, I think there's so much power in intention, you know, which is really the motive force of the universe. And so anyway, that's kind of the eco-psychology, you know, radical eco-psychology view. And I've been carrying this phrase, planetary hospice, around in my head for, like, years. I didn't really know why. It was just there. And it resonated. And I just sort of kept it there in the back of my mind. And when I was going through the training program at Zen Hospice, which is amazing, I was also studying the psychology of death and dying with Alessandra Strada at CIIS. And I decided it was time, you know, to explore this idea in a paper. And she was very encouraging of that. So that was sort of where the paper came from. And, you know, hospice is really all about transforming the way we think about life and death by bringing up unresolved grief over the losses that we've suffered and seeing the grieving process itself as life-affirming. You know, we fundamentally transform our relationship to grief through hospice training. And so we're all starting to experience these great losses now that are unimaginable in scope and scale, like nothing we've ever had to deal with psychologically in the natural world. And in fact, we've been experiencing them for some time, you know, both each of us sort of in our own way and at our own pace. And I feel it's imperative for us now to get in touch with our grieving process, our grief, our brokenheartedness, not just as a way of affirming life, but of restoring life by restoring the balance between our humanity and our true nature, you know, our kind of natural, grounded, cooperative and compassionate way of being.
You know, I really, really appreciate that. And on this show, we have had a number of people speaking about grief from different perspectives. And you mentioned California Institute of Integral Studies, which I want to put in a big plug for. I didn't attend that school, but I have the greatest respect for many people who did. You mentioned Craig Chalquist, who's going to be writing the foreword for my next book, Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse. And you didn't mention Linda Bazell, but I'm sure you're aware of her. She was on this show a few months ago talking about eco-psychology. So you've given us a really beautiful context now for the next bit of questions that I'm going to ask you. You've been carrying this thought, this feeling, this image of planetary hospice with you for a long time. And you wrote the first article and then the second article about it, about a terminal diagnosis for planet Earth. And would you say more about this in relation to the failure of mainstream psychology and the suppression of our connection with Mother Earth and the epidemic proportions that we're seeing right now in mental illness?
Well, yeah, I wrote a 37-page paper about that. But from both a Buddhist perspective and perspective of Jungian psychology, which, you know, Jung was obviously way ahead of his time. And now also from the perspective of quantum physics, which I think Jung was also influenced by, there's this idea of collective consciousness. And deep down, you know, we're united by a shared awareness. That's basically the beginning. And we're connected not just with ourselves, with each other, you know, and all humanity, but all of nature,
yes.
All of life, and including the planet herself. So at that level of primal awareness, we know what's happening, even if we can't admit it or we're not conscious of it, or we don't have words for it. You know, it can be just a feeling. And what happens when we know deep down, for example, that we're causing widespread ecological destruction and species extinction? Well, you know, if we don't allow that awareness to fully surface in our personal consciousness and give it its due, then obviously we can't grieve loss. That's, you know, that's obvious. But also what happens when we repress important things like that in our unconscious mind is that they emerge in shadow forms, like mental illness. And, you know, it's natural to feel anxious or even depressed about what we're doing to the planet. But if you live in a big city and you go for, you're feeling anxious and depressed and you go for professional help, and the psychologist only asks you about your relationship to your mother or your spouse, or asks about your work situation, and, you know, never gets around to asking you about your relationship to nature, the ground of your very being in the world, which is still the norm, you know, that's still how psychologists and psychiatrists function, then you end up on pills. And, you know, that's what we see today. We, even our kids are medicated for acting out.
Early in life, usually.
Yeah. So we're treating the symptoms while we're ignoring the disease. And the pharmaceutical companies get rich off of this, of course, but the whole planet suffers from not processing through this. And when you really think about it, the source of all of our problems in this world is the unacknowledged fears and unresolved grief that we carry around. And it gets acted out on, you know, in so many destructive ways, including everything that's going on in the world now that you were referring to at the beginning of the show. So that's the eco-psychological explanation for why we're seeing this epidemic of mental illness during the very same period of time when it's become apparent to us that something is very wrong in our relationship to the planet.
I think that oftentimes, you know, and certainly has been my experience with people who've consulted me for life coaching, not all of them, but for many of them, you know, they tell me that they've been to therapists and they've tried to talk about their connection with nature, or they've tried to talk about the collapse of industrial civilization, and, you know, they've been perceived as paranoid or, you know, not really in their bodies or something like that. And, you know, so it's really, there are so few, it seems to me, so few mental health professionals that really have this broad scope of the larger picture that you're talking about and that I certainly perceive as I work with people.
Yeah, I don't think they even really, I don't think, traditional mainstream psychology even really understands what mental illness is about because, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, we're all mentally ill.
Yes.
We're, our culture and our society are the source of illness and dysfunction, right? And what happens is that those who are most sensitive among us and don't have the defenses against that dysfunction, they end up, you know, suffering from it and acting it out because they just can't take it. And so they, you know, I thought about this a lot when, back in the 90s, you know, late 80s and 90s when, you know, I think kids were like the most sensitive of all of a sudden everyone was like piercing and tattooing and, you know, dressing in black and mutilating themselves, basically, you know,
mm-hmm.
and feeling despair, like their whole lifestyle just screamed despair. And
right.
I'm just like, well, yeah, naturally, because they know, they feel what's going on, you know, and they're acting it out, and nobody's telling them why they're like that, you know.
Exactly.
All it's like, oh, you're antisocial, you're a problem, mm-hmm. you know, get with it, grow up, and all that kind of stuff. And so I just feel like the psychology movement in general tends to fail people at a very fundamental, basic level there by labeling them, by saying, oh, you're mentally ill, you're a problem, or whatever, instead
right.
of coming from a place of, you know, we're all suffering.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree with you. Well, you know, on this show, sometimes I include music and sometimes I don't. And I wasn't planning to play a song tonight, but you requested that I play The Story in Your Eyes by the Moody Blues. And after we listen, I'd like you to comment on why we chose this song. So let's listen, The Story in Your Eyes.
Carolyn, do you mind if I do a special dedication in honor of Casey Kasem passing recently?
Absolutely. Let's honor Casey Kasem.
Yeah,
okay.
I want to send this out to my homeboys in Colorado there, Denny Lane and Yaz, Marty Yaslowitz, and also to my dear mother who's 86 years old, and she's listening in Chicago, and all my family out there. I love you all.
Thank you, Shiva, and let's listen to The Story in Your Eyes by the Moody Blues. So that was The Story in Your Eyes by the Moody Blues, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and we're talking with Jiwa Woodbury about the notion of planetary hospice. Jiwa, can you say more about why you chose this song?
Oh, wow. The Moody Blues, their lyrics are just so deep and come from that same place of awareness that we've been talking about. That song could easily be written today about the climate crisis.
Yes.
And it's uncanny almost, but, you know, and it was written before we had any idea about what was going on with the climate. And, that's an example of the spirit of the earth, that the anima mundi talking to us out of time through art, you know, through artists about what's really happening. And I just really love that. What I really love about that song is the tone of it. You know, it's deeply soulful, profoundly meaningful. It's melancholy and kind of dark. All of their music is, but, but it's also redemptive, ultimately, and even hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the line in that song, "We're part of the fire that is burning, and from the ashes we can build another day," and that's planetary hospice.
Mm-hmm. So you're a hospice worker and a practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism, both of which are very involved with death. So I must ask you, and I'm sure our listeners want to know, do you think a good death is possible? And if so, what would it look like? And also, why is death such an integral part of Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism?
Yeah, well, you know, look, from a Buddhist perspective, death is as much a part of life as life is a part of death. It's non-dual. There's no separation.
Mm.
And in Tibetan Buddhism, we practice the stages of dying every day. Because if you want something to go well, you know, it helps to prepare, right? And,
right.
But in preparing for death, you know, in sort of going through the dying process in our meditation, there's this great side benefit, which is if you die every day, then life becomes so precious and so beautiful, and you cherish it so much, you know. And, you know, it's not just a Buddhist perspective. You know, even Jesus said we need to die in order that we may live. You know, he wasn't speaking to the afterlife. He was trying to point out the kingdom of heaven that's right here on earth. So that's what a good death is based on. A good life, and seeing the two, and not seeing the two as separate, even in time. So we have to accept the fact that we're dying moment by moment in order to truly live our life fully. Breath by breath, we're expiring. You know, to expire means both to die and to breathe out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an ongoing process. We should be very intimate with it and not, you know, like separated psychologically from the idea of death and dying, because then we become like zombies or sleepwalkers. You know, we're controlled by that which we repress, by our unacknowledged fear of death. That's really the motive force in the world right now.
Yes.
And of course, then we project that out onto nature and the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, because of a cultural conditioning, they go through their life on autopilot with junky minds, you know, just going from distraction to distraction. And that's most people's lot in life, and it's really sad, you know. So when you ask me if a good death is possible, and I'm assuming you mean collectively, the planetary, my answer unequivocally is yes, you know, of course it is, but we have to begin by acknowledging our fear at every level, not just of our own mortality, although that's where we start, you know, but also accepting the fact that life as we know it, as we have always known it, as a species, with all of its rich diversity, the web of life, it's ending. That web is broken, and that's the terminal diagnosis that underlies planetary hospice. So if we can just deal with that and face it, we can find liberation there. And this is what people who are desperately grasping and clinging, even with good intention, you know, they don't see that there's liberation and disintegration they're too afraid of insecurity and uncertainty. But in the planetary hospice approach, we don't give up, but we let go,
mm-hmm.
and we realize like life is cyclic; it's not linear. Whatever is dying is also giving birth to something new, and you see this in hospice. Anybody who's ever done hospice and sat with somebody who is actively dying, it's surprisingly similar to the birth process.
Mm-hmm.
They go into labor. There's like this labored breathing, and it can last hours or days, just like labor for birth. And it's painful and it's difficult, just like birth. And then there's release, and then there's crying, and it can be joyful too. You know, we experience that a lot at some hospice.
Well, I'm very glad you're describing that, because one of the things I felt compelled to ask you after you talked about, are we talking about a collective death or not, is I wanted to ask you about the individual death and what a good death individually looks like, and you've pretty much described that.
Yeah, we see it all the time. It's just people that have accepted the fact that they're dying and that die with love, the people around them. We surround people with love and affirmation, and their family comes in and feeds off of that. And, you sit and just hold somebody's hand when they're dying. That's really, and let them know, hey, there's nothing to be afraid of. This is natural,
mm-hmm.
And the body dies,
Yeah.
The body dies. Not everything else goes on. And when people have faith in that, they die peacefully, and you can see that, you can feel it, and then people that are around them and their family and the supported community, it's more often that we celebrate the end of life at Zen Hospice than feel sad and remorse.
Mm-hmm.
But that's always because the family members and the person that's dying, they accept what's happening.
Well, I want to ask you one more question before we start taking callers. I've got several questions here, the next one I want to ask you is about the word hope. We hear so much about hope these days, and the moment we talk about death or the reality of planetary hospice, many people immediately argue that, well, we have to have hope. And I'm quite sure that your definition of hope is very different from the definition offered by mainstream culture. So would you please talk about that? And also, can you talk about the culture of denial, which constantly obscures our unacknowledged fears and despair?
Yeah, I want to just say, right before I get to that, I just want to say one thing about the grieving and the end of life and
sure.
the fact that and the idea of a good death, because right now we can see that the world's in the grip of unacknowledged fears and it's playing out. It seems to me that we're dealing with all the stages of grief over the planetary situation, except the final one, which is acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key. We have denial, anger, bargaining, and depression. You can see that playing out everywhere,
Right.
And we have to get to acceptance in order for the end of life as we know it to give birth to something beautiful and life-affirming. And, that's kind of the spiritual midwifery component of planetary hospice. And that leads naturally to the idea of hope. A big part of hospice involves redefining hope. When someone accepts the fact that they're dying, that there's no cure for whatever their disease is, then rather than giving up hope, they're asked to redefine it. And
mm-hmm.
That's the beginning of the healing process, of transforming the dying process into a healing process. And, what would you like your death process to look like? And, where do you want to die? And how do you imagine your death? You want music, candles, loved ones, things like that, And the science and politics of climate change are really clear. If you're still hoping for a reversal of the process, you're in denial. There's
mm-hmm.
no fix at this
mm-hmm.
point.
Yeah.
We can't go back to the way things were. And we know, because the lag time, we're in, if things are going to continue spiraling kind of downward for at least the next few decades. So it's just a question of how difficult things are going to get. And we're already seeing, you know, mass mortality and migrations in areas most affected by climate change. Most people still don't realize that Syria, the conflict there was precipitated by drought and, mm-hmm. and farmers not being able to grow crops and coming into the cities angry and
right.
Being put down. I'm actually hopeful, Carolyn, that that we are going to get to the level of acceptance and that once we do, once there's a critical mass of awareness and we set our minds to alleviating all the suffering that is going to transpire in this world, this sort of great dying, that it's going to trigger a spiritual awakening. It has to, you know, if we're going to survive. And I think we're already seeing signs of that. You know, I think that Joanna Macy is way out in front of everybody on that with her great turning.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening. But we tend to overlook this. You know, certainly the media doesn't pay attention to it.
Right.
So you have to look for it. But we all, one thing that, you know, really stands out to me is how everybody gets how connected we are now. Everyone understands how interdependent life is.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is a quantum leap in consciousness. You
mm-hmm.
know, people didn't feel that way 10, 20 years ago.
Right.
And that's a response. That's a psychological response to what's happening. And it's sort of a beginning, just the beginning ground of this awakening through awareness. And, you know, I'm sort of a short-term pessimist, long-term optimist, you know.
I like that.
It's not going to be easy at all. It's going to be the hardest thing we've ever tried to do as a species. But, you know, as my dad always reminded me, nothing that is worthwhile in this life comes easy.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of our great successes are built on big piles of failure. That's the human story. And
right.
Now we're playing that out on a big stage.
And I think also from the Buddhist perspective, you know, we do, as Guy was talking about last week, we do the right thing and we do service and we express our compassion because it's the right thing to do and we don't focus so much on outcome.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because I was thinking about this yesterday actually in an eco-resilience workshop with Craig. He was talking about hopelessness, and I heard you talking about it last week. And just like in regular hospice, we ask people to redefine the hope. I think that we in planetary hospice that we need to redefine hopelessness because, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, hopelessness looks like right conduct.
Uh-huh.
It's like you do something because it's right, not
right.
because you're expecting some specific outcome, or you're going to save the world or whatever, you know.
I love that.
It's just right conduct, and
yeah.
it's not based on what your hope for the future is, right? So there's a certain power in hopelessness. We tend to think of we tend to equate hopelessness and despair. And despair is totally inappropriate and response and unnecessary. It's just, you know, despair is like unresolved grief or something.
Right. And also the antidote to despair is action, as Edward Abbey
yeah.
reminds us.
Yeah, do something.
And so I understand we have one caller on hold, Martin from Canada. I'd like to hear from Martin. You have a question for Shiva?
Hello. Hello?
Hi, Martin.
Yeah.
Hi. No, I don't have a question, but I have to say that as I'm sitting here listening, it feels as though, you know, the thoughts in my mind, you know, have at times sometimes felt a bit muddy. Like I so much of what you have to say, your guest has to say, and the last couple shows have to say has kind of just resonated with me, but just the last couple of minutes, I something came to mind that the muddied water is becoming more and more clear. And anyway, the purpose of my call, Carolyn, is to say that I really, really like Mike Rupert. I listened for a long, long time. But the last, since you've taken over, there's a shift, a huge shift has occurred, and it's becoming more and more clear. I don't only listen because I want to find out what the latest thing is going on. And there really is a movement forward. There's a wave washing over us. And anyway, I'm not exactly sure what I want to say, except thank you so much. I love the show so much. So much speaks to me and to so many people, and you are just, your guests are amazing. Thank you. And I'm at a loss for words. I'm sitting here in my little cabin outside of Ottawa, Ontario, and sitting in the dark. I'm off grid, so I try to conserve my energy. I've got my laptop on, and now I'm listening on the phone, and I really look forward. This is the highlight of my week, listening to you and your guests, and you're making a huge difference. And again, I'm not so eloquent right at the moment, but everything just speaks to me, and an analogy that comes to mind was the muddied, soupy water that, like, the flowing of the stream is getting more and more clear. Mm. And I'm not a young man. I build biodomes, and I live off grid, and I do all kinds of things. But there doesn't seem to be any common thread in my life apart from, you know, I'm doing the best I can, and I'm connecting with all sorts of interesting, eclectic folks. But somehow listening to your show brings it all together.
Well, I'm very, very glad to hear that,
anyway,
Martin.
Thank you
so much for the kudos. Thank you for calling in. It's beautiful to hear that muddy waters are becoming clearer, and if I can have a part in that and my guests can have a part in that, that's wonderful. So
yeah,
thank you.
That loss of words is really powerful, you know?
That loss of words is really powerful, as Jiwa says.
Yeah, sit with that.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much.
Okay, and okay. Thank you again, and please keep doing what you're doing. And I love you, and your guest, you. Thank you so much. Bless you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Mm-hmm.
Good night.
Thank you, Martin. We're certainly going to begin taking callers, and we'd like you to call us at 888-874-4888 with a question or comment for Jiwa or myself. We'll do our best to take your call, but as I said earlier, please bear in mind that our lines get swamped sometimes, and we can't take all of the calls that come in. So while we're waiting for callers, I want to ask Jiwa another question. And, you know, Martin just called in from Canada, and there is someone in Canada, Jiwa, that we both greatly admire, Stephen Jenkinson, who from his YouTube videos online has become known as the Grief Walker. He's someone I definitely want to have on this show at some point, and I'm wondering if you've had any direct contact with him and why you admire his work so much. I think that you're more familiar with his background than I am, so please talk about that, because it seems like the two of you are doing very similar work in the world.
Wow, yeah, just to be mentioned in the same sentence with Stephen Jenkinson is really humbling to me. You know, he was here in the Bay Area for a showing of his film and a workshop last semester, just in the last year, and I wanted to go so bad, and I couldn't. He did it on the same day that I was serving at Zen Hospice, and I couldn't get away. So
yeah.
Some irony there. But if there's anyone listening to this who has not seen Grief Walker, you can find it online for free, and please watch it, and you can thank us later, because it's one of the best things you can do for yourself.
YouTube, yeah.
It's all, you can find it on Vimeo, all kinds of places.
And, okay.
And it's the best thing you'll do for your loved ones, and it's the best thing you can do for your mother or Earth, just to watch that and go through it. He's amazing, and he's a product of the palliative care movement in Canada, which is all about treating the whole person in illness. Planetary Hospice itself is palliative in nature, which basically means, you know, to alleviate or reduce suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So he became known as the Angel of Death because he always seemed to show up when people were dying, and he would transform their dying experience into a healing experience. And he has figured out more than anyone, he basically is a voice for Native indigenous wisdom, which he's mm-hmm. sort of wholeheartedly adopted. So I shouldn't say, you know, maybe before any, more than anyone, any European before, how to bring grief out onto our path in a way that makes all of life sacred.
Yes. Well, indigenous wisdom just, you know, really gets that.
Yeah. An example, a powerful example is he talks about when we fall in love with someone, that we need to fall in love with their whole story right there, right up front, including the end of their story. And mm-hmm. when they're dying, we don't just accept their dying. We love their dying person. We love the dying process, which is really radical. And, I mean, he explains it a lot in that film a lot better than I do with actual living dying examples right there. But the key is that by not living in denial and fear of old age, sickness, dying, and death, this sounds a little bit like Buddha, by loving it all in the moment when it may seem so remote, not only do we appreciate the being that we're relating to so much more deeply and authentically, but also nothing gets stuffed. And so when we get to the end, there's not all this pent-up emotion to cloud our experience, and we can mm-hmm. fully be there with the experience and transform it that way. So it's so beautiful. And, you know, I know you know who Llewellyn Vaughn Lee is.
Yes, yes.
I just got this quote on Facebook from him today that's right on point. He said, do we have the courage to hold the grief that comes with the end of a story? You can only hold the beginning if you are prepared to also hold the grief for what is over. Otherwise, a certain maturity is lacking. At this mm-hmm. time, we're all being called upon to recognize the bigger story, which is not the story of supermarkets, not the story of politicians, not the story of religious fanatics, but the story of Earth at this time.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that quote. I actually did put that quote at the very top of my daily news digest today that I have been publishing for 7 years, 7 days a week. So there was a beautiful image that came with that quote, mm-hmm. I think, of an open book with the earth in it. It was just really beautiful, beautiful image. So, Jiwa, what is your plan going forward in terms of the planetary hospice movement? And as he's answering this, please call us at 888-874-4888 with a question or comment.
Okay. Well, right now I'm focused on building and strengthening the spiritual container to hold the planetary hospice movement. That's kind of my training. And it seems to have a life and a will of its own. When I wrote that paper, I certainly didn't anticipate any of this. And so I'm just kind of nurturing it along right now, and I've got a website up, planetaryhospice-hyphenated.com. Mm-hmm. And my intention is to let it grow organically. It's kind of at a conceptual stage right now, and what I'd like to see is for it to eventually become a kind of, you know, a hospice without borders effort aimed at alleviating suffering and facilitating mm-hmm. healing and spiritual mm-hmm. rebirth during these difficult times mm-hmm. and sort of be a sort of virtual hub for that sort of wheel of healing. So it's kind of like the relationship psychologically between spiritual emergency and spiritual emergence, you know. Mm-hmm. Stan Grof and I've done a lot of work on the idea that spiritual emergency is a great opportunity for emerging spiritually.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's the idea behind planetary hospice.
And often, you know, and I don't want to just kind of go away from that term, spiritual emergence, because very often when people are in some sort of what seems to be a personal crisis, it is a personal crisis, but it's also a spiritual emergency. And, you know, go ahead and say more about that if you like.
Yeah, well, what we do with those people, we tend to, like, drug them. And mm-hmm. what happens then psychologically is it traps them in that hell realm that they're trapped in, and it doesn't allow them to process through it. Whereas,
right.
you know, it's like where they're in this dark place, there's light, but you have to process through the darkness to get to the light. And and the drugs like prevent that from happening. And you know, there's been lots of research and actual positive results with people with schizophrenia, you know, that if you don't drug them, you can actually get them through the process, you know, and then they can come out the other side. So that's it. Anybody who's ever gone through, and I'm including myself here, you know, a dark night of the soul and a mental, spiritual, emotional breakdown, if you're surrounded by love and support and you don't, you know, like deny what's going on, it leads you through to an amazing spiritual awakening. You know, that's the beauty of life, and we can't like deny that. We have to facilitate that. So that's the idea of spiritual emergence that comes out of you know, the humus, you know, humanity and
right.
The humus of our soul. It's not messy. I mean, it's messy. It's not like neat and pretty and everything, and but it's life, you know.
Absolutely. And can you tell our listeners how we can cultivate eco-resilience? How can we help with this process that you're talking about?
Well, if everybody can become a planetary caregiver. That's just like when I was talking about the power of intention, you know, that's the start. My papers, the two papers that I've done are rather long. I'm really shocked that so many people have actually read through the first one.
They're long and wonderful, and they deserve reading several times, and I can't get enough of them.
they're written in order to facilitate the inner process. So I had a fellow hospice caregiver come up to me recently who just happened to find it online and hadn't told him about it, told her about it. But she told me she found it, she read it, and it put her in touch with her denial, which really, you know, I so appreciated that coming from another hospice caregiver. If people find themselves motivated, you know, after reading that and checking this out, you know, to be a part of this movement, which I think is going to just continue to grow, what I encourage them to do is actually find a local hospice provider that appeals to them and volunteer, you know, because it's a way not only to get the training of calling up and dealing with your own unresolved grief, which is like an amazing gift in itself, but then going on to do the hospice caregiving itself is a way of acquiring the tools that we're going to need as a species to respond compassionately to the climate crisis.
I have found so many people benefit from that experience, and I want to make sure that people know how to get in touch with you and get involved.
Well, you can, you know, because it's important that we start by building these networks and getting them in place. If people are listening right now, go to the website, Planetary Hospice, it's hyphenated.com, and just leave me an email. Let me know what your interests and motivations are, and I'll respond in kind. And slowly, you know, slowly we'll build this movement. I mean, that's my idea behind the website, is eventually for people that find it, to connect them with folks like you and Joanna and Guy, and, you know, to become a resource for, you know, or hospice resources, Buddhist, you know, Dharma, whatever, you know, spiritual, life coaching, that sort of thing, you know, like, so yeah, if people feel moved, just go and send me an email, and I promise I'll respond.
And people do not need to be involved with the Buddhist tradition, correct?
No,
I mean, anyone can get involved.
No, even Zen Hospice, we're not all, there's not, you don't have to be a Buddhist to you know, work at Zen Hospice, so, yeah.
Right.
Now, Buddhism is not, you know, it's not a religion. I don't think of it as a religion anyhow. To me, it's psychology.
Yeah. It's a psychology, and it's a way of looking at life, and it's just been terrific to have you on the show. I am so honored to have you here. I've read your papers over and over. I've shared them with people. I just, like I said, I can't get enough of your wisdom. We so need it right now in the world. So I want to thank you for being with us, Zhiwa, and I just want to remind our listeners that all of our shows are archived immediately after the show and can be accessed by going to PRN-FM, clicking on shows, and then scrolling down to the Lifeboat Hour. Again, thank you, Jiwa, and everyone, please join us again next week with Abby Martin right here on the Lifeboat Hour. I'm Carolyn Baker. Have a good week.
Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows.